at least for this audience. The most important one is the quark gluon plasma. It's expected to be seen in things like heavy ion collisions, and also it's important in the evolution of the early universe. Okay, so I'll go through briefly some formalisms of finite temperature field theory and some new problems that arise, or new subtleties that arise when you're using such formalisms. And as a result of that, it'd be nice to be able to have some system that would that you could look at where this formalism could be, in a sense, tested out. And that's what I'm going to look at the end. And that's the Bose-Einstein condensation. And we're going to look at some thermodynamic properties of such a system, and also the behavior of the system near the critical point. Okay, so probably the most familiar example of using finite temperature field theory is in the quark gluon plasma. And it's expected that at some room temperature, the quarks are confined inside of nuclei along with the gluons. And then if you add a suitable amount of heat and pressure, you get a quark gluon plasma, where the quarks and the gluons are essentially free to migrate. The boundaries of the nuclei get washed out. And it's expected to be seen in heavy ion collisions, where you collide very heavy ions at very high speeds. Temperatures are typically around 170 MeV, with densities of about 1 GeV per cubic Fermi. The signatures of such a plasma are expected, a lot of signatures are expected to be enhanced production rates of various particles, like photons. And in April of last year, it was tentatively claimed that such a plasma was seen at RIC, at the Relativistic Heavy Ion Collider in Brookhaven. And this is, it's still, I don't think, completely accepted that such a plasma was seen. There's a lot of, it's a very complicated system, and you get out a tremendous amount of data. But one explanation of what they have seen is that such a plasma was formed. Okay, and another motivation for studying such a quark gluon plasma is in the evolution of the early universe. And we've seen yesterday in the cosmology session some examples of that. Okay. In the early universe, shortly after the Big Bang, a quark gluon plasma was expected to be formed. And as the universe cooled, the quarks and the gluons and condensed into nuclei, and then the nuclei, the protons and the neutrons, which then formed nuclei down here, and then eventually we get atoms. Okay. But in the very early universe, a quark gluon plasma was expected to be formed. Okay. And so it's important to understand how to do calculations with fields at high temperatures and high densities. Now, at high temperatures or at finite temperatures, there's different types of formalisms where you can include temperature effects and density effects in quantum field theory. The basic thing that you have to take into account is that at zero temperature, you're interested in calculating vacuum expectation values of various operators. And at finite temperature, those vacuum expectation values go into thermal averages, where you trace over the thermal heat bath. And it's weighted by the e to the minus beta h, where beta here is 1 over the Boltzmann's constant times the temperature. Okay, now this, if you apply this vacuum, or this, if you look at the two-point Green's function, the propagator, at finite temperature, it looks something like this. I forgot a time-ordered product there. If you use the fact that the fields evolve with the Hamiltonian in time, and then also use the fact that the trace identity, the trace of an operator AB is equal to the trace of BA, what you can find, or what you can show, is that the Green's function, the two-point function, has a periodicity in imaginary time. And that periodicity is minus I beta, 1 over the temperature. Okay, so the main thing at finite temperature, when you start to calculate Green's functions, is that you have to take into account this periodicity. And the first formalism which did this was called the imaginary time formalism, or the maps of error formalism. And in this formalism, time is rotated into imaginary time, minus I tau. Consequently, if you have integrals over time at zero temperature from minus to plus infinity, those go into finite integrals from zero to beta because of the periodicity. Now, if you go into momentum space, the energy K0 gets replaced because of this finite interval. When you go into momentum space, a Fourier integral becomes a Fourier, Fourier sum, and the energies become discrete, I 2 pi n times beta, where n here is an integer, 0, plus or minus 1, and 2, 3, and so on. Okay. And consequently, integrals at zero temperature over energies become maps of error sums, where you sum over the discrete label n. So in the imaginary time formalism, Feynman rules involve substituting energies by these discrete values, and then the integrals over energies become maps of error sums. Okay? And you can calculate just as you do at zero temperature with these modified Feynman rules. Now these maps of error sums can be done with contour methods. What you end up with is something that involves the temperature. If you, at the end of the day, if you need things in real time, what that will then involve is a analytic continuation back to real time from the imaginary time. Okay. And so the maps of error formalism has these complications of discrete sums and also possibly analytic continuations if you need things in real time. Now, as another formalism was developed after the maps of error formalism about 30 years ago, and that's called the real-time formalism. And in the real-time formalism, instead of going in time from 0 to minus I beta, what you do is go along the real axis out to some, well, that's an unfortunate T here, to some large time. You then go down the imaginary axis an amount, and then go back, and then eventually get back to minus I beta. So you're still going from 0 to minus I beta, but you're going along this funny contour. Now, if you go through the through the derivation of the two-point function, what you find is that the contribution from these end pieces here along the imaginary axis decouple and can be neglected in the limit that capital T there goes to infinity. And what you end up with for the two-point function is a matrix form for the propagator. You get contributions from the from this contour 1 along the real axis, and you get contributions from the contour 2. And this propagator involves contributions from 1, 1, and then 1, 2 along the off-diagonal elements, and 2, 1, and then a propagator 2, 2. The form of the propagator for bosons looks something like this. You have the zero temperature piece. This is for the 1-1 component. And then you have a finite temperature piece involving the distribution function n, which is 1 over e to the beta energy minus 1. The off-diagonal elements involve a purely thermal contribution where the particles are on the mass shell. You have this delta function here. Okay, so in the real-time formalism, everything's done in real time. The energies are real. The price you pay, though, is that there's a doubling of the number of degrees of freedom. And for example, if you were to consider the in a phi cube theory, this two-point function at two loops, instead of just having one graph as you would at zero temperature, what you end up with is four graphs where you have to sum over the vertices 1 and 2 in each of these graphs. And so you get a doubling of the number of degrees of freedom. And you have to, in the internal vertices, take into account these off-diagonal elements. Hey, some notes here about the real-time formalism. Because of this presence of this of the thermal factor, 1 over e to the beta energy minus 1, there are no additional ultraviolet divergences at finite temperature because they're suppressed by this factor. Okay. However, at least for bosons, there may be some additional infrared divergences because as k0 goes to 0, you get to expand this exponential and you get 1 over k0, okay, which can be problematic at k0 equal to 0. And also, as a technical note, if you do this sum in here, in this example, individual terms have products that go like 1 over the k squared minus m squared propagator times a delta function. And this product is ill-defined. It's not defined as a distribution. And what you have to find at the end of the day is such products cancel in the end. Okay. So there's some various complications in the real-time formalism due to this fact and also due to the additional infrared divergences. Right. Now, as I mentioned, one of the signatures expected in the quark gluon plasma at finite temperature is an enhanced production rate of various particles. And that production, or that enhancement, comes about from the finite temperature effects. If, for example, you calculate the imaginary part just of a one-loop graph and relate it to a decay rate of some particle, at zero temperature, you get a certain contribution. But at finite temperature, you get additional contributions that are not present at zero temperature. And that's due to the fact that at finite temperature, you can get particles that can come out of the heat bath and go into the heat bath. There's a bigger phase space available for decay rates. Hey, however, if you try to apply this formalism to, for example, QCD, you find that there's a number of problems that arise. And one of the first problems that was pointed out was calculating the one-loop gluon self-energy in pure QCD. If you do that, what you find is that the real part of this self-energy goes like T squared, the temperature squared, for large temperatures. And this is like a finite temperature mass. Okay. It turns out to be gauge independent, but the imaginary part of that self-energy goes like GT, where G is the gauge coupling constant, and that turns out to be gauge dependent. Okay. However, the poles of a propagator can be shown to be gauge independent. So the fact that you get a gauge dependence here means that in, at least in QCD, the loop expansion is breaking down. And so what you have to do is modify the loop expansion, do what's called a resummation. And that resummation was developed about 15 years ago by Bratton and Fizarski. And it now goes by the name of Bratton-Fizarski resummation scheme. And in that, effectively, what you end up doing is using modified propagators and modified vertices. These blobs here are the modified ones. These modified ones, though, are momentum dependent, and they're quite, it takes a lot of technology in order to use such a perturbation theory in order to calculate things. Okay, but it can be done, and it can be shown with this resummation scheme that, for example, the lowest order corrections to the propagator result in gauge independent poles. So because of these complications of finite temperature, these additional sort of problems that come up, infrared divergences, technical problems in evaluating things, it would be nice to have some model that you could actually compare with experiment to see if the formalism is giving the right thing. Okay. And so what we did, or what me and my graduate student did, is looked at a non-relativistic system, which is Bose-Einstein condensation. And just to describe this briefly, Bose-Einstein condensation results from taking a gas of bosons and then lowering the temperature. And this argument here, if you look at an energy proportional to kV times the temperature, you can convert that into a momentum, and then using the de Broglie relationship, the associated wavelength goes like h over the momentum, which is h over the square root of the temperature. At room temperature, this wavelength is quite small compared to the distance between atoms, for example. And what that means is that the atoms are distinguishable. But as you lower the temperature, this wavelength becomes quite large, and at some point, this wavelength will be comparable to the distance between the atoms. And at that point, the atoms start to lose their distinguishability. They start to merge together in some sense. And the resultant system is described by Bose-Einstein statistics. And what you end up getting is that at a certain temperature, a Bose-Einstein condensate occurs. And it's described by a single macroscopic wave function. And it's a really nice system to use to study fundamental quantum mechanics. You can, for example, look at interference between nearby condensates. Now, the experimental history of this is that in 1938, a helium-4 was cooled to about 2.2 degrees Kelvin, and it was found to have some weird properties. It's now called a superfluid. It has zero viscosity. There's no impediment to the flow. There's quantized vortices, an infinite thermal conductivity. This was turned out to be the first example of what's now called a Bose-Einstein condensate. Now, it's not a true Bose-Einstein condensate because it's a fluid, and there's still a lot of strong interactions present in the fluid. The first true Bose-Einstein condensate was found in 1995, What was done was cooled about 2,000 rubidium atoms to about 170 nanokelvin to that temperature. And what you get is what's now called a true Bose-Einstein condensation. And it's won the Nobel Prize in 2001. Okay. So what we're going to do is look at, we're going to take helium-4, actually, as a system, and look at its behavior at finite temperature and see if we can reproduce, using all of the technology of finite temperature field theory, some of the results that have been found experimentally. All right, so the model that we're going to take is sort of a standard model. You have a Hamiltonian composed of a free part plus an interacting part. The free part just has the kinetic term for the boson, psi, plus a chemical potential mu times the number of particles n. The interaction part is composed, or is in general, a term like this. It's a four-point interaction, psi dagger, psi, psi, with some interaction term u. And u we're going to take as a point interaction involving a delta function. Potential is characterized by a scattering length F and also the mass of the boson down here. You can write down the field equations for psi and then write psi as a normal phase, psi prime, plus this theta term, which is describing the condensate. It's essentially the square root of N0, the number density in the condensed phase. Okay. The Green's functions that we're interested in are the, there's turns out to be two of them. One is the two-point function, G, composed out of a condensed phase plus the normal phase. And then there's also this, this function F, which is made up of two psi terms, which then connect n particles to n minus two particles. You can set up perturbation theory in this system and start to turn the crank. And what you end up doing, what we ended up doing, is going to second order in perturbation theory. Okay, now, the procedure for doing this and for getting some results out is numerical in nature. What you have to do is, first of all, fix the temperature that you're interested in, plus the density of the gas in the normal phase. And we took the density to be the density of helium. Helium-4 at room temperature. Then we chose a form for the chemical potential mu, substituted that in the definition of n, which is n0 plus the two-point function at time 0 and space 0. And what you end up doing then is solving for the chemical potential in this equation. You could then look at the free energy F and find that as a function of N0 and mu, which we've assumed up here, and then the temperature and N. And then what we do is look for a minimum of this free energy. Vary the parameters N0 and mu so as to find a free find the minimum. Now that minimum will, in the first iteration, will not correspond to what we assumed up here. So what we then do is take what we found from the minimum, go back to the second set, put that in, solve again for the minimum, and keep on going until you reach self-consistency. Okay? Until you don't, till the minimum corresponds to what you found in step two up here. Okay? So it's a non-linear numerical problem in order to do this. Okay? But once you do it, once you find the free energy, you could then start to calculate things like the specific heat and the internal energy and things like that. Now, internal energy. This is some of the results. The zero, the tree level mean field approximation is indicated by this zero here. First order perturbation theory leads to something like this, but it's sort of flat. The second order perturbation theory leads to a discontinuity at the critical temperature. That's sort of a bit off there, but that's supposed to be occurring at the critical temperature. And if you calculate the specific heat from this internal energy, that's a derivative, what you find is that in second order, the specific heat diverges at the critical temperature. And that's indeed what is found experimentally. So what this shows is that if you want to at least explain things that even qualitatively, what you have to do is go to second order perturbation theory. But the point of this is that I didn't put the numbers down here, but numerically, you find that the results you get out from this procedure agree with what is found experimentally for the specific heat. Now, another thing of interest is to find what the critical temperature is. And for that, what we could look at is this ratio, N0 over N, where N0 is the number of particles in the condensed phase, and N is the number of particles overall, and look at the behavior of this as the temperature approaches the critical temperature. And what you find is that it goes like Tc, the critical temperature, minus T, raised to some power beta. And that's an unfortunate choice of notation. Beta here is the critical exponent. You could calculate this within this model. In order to do that, just like you have to do sort of in non-relativistic calculating the specific heat of a Bose system, you have to put in an ultraviolet cutoff. And if you do so, you get predictions for these parameters of this quantity that you can adjust the cutoff so that those values agree with what is found experimentally. Okay? And in particular, we can get the value of the critical temperature to within a pretty good accuracy, as well as the value of the critical exponent beta. Classically, beta is equal to 1/2. And so the fact that you get a range of 0.3 to 0.38, which is found experimentally, sort of validates this, this procedure. Okay, so in conclusion, okay, what we've done is used helium-4, a gas of helium-4, as a testing ground for finite temperature field theory. It's an interesting system in its own right, so we don't have to justify using finite temperature based on other things. It's an interesting system as a testing ground, though, because it's a relatively strongly coupled theory, which QCD is expected to be. And also, it's a system that you can look at near the critical temperature, and that tests whether or not this assumption of equilibrium is justified or not. Because at the critical temperature, you're expecting things to change a lot, whereas this equilibrium theory, because we get fairly good agreement with experiment, this sort of validates the use of equilibrium theory. And probably the main lesson to be drawn from this is that you can calculate things with this theory, but you have to go to second order in perturbation theory to even get the right qualitative forms of various quantities. First order perturbation theory isn't enough in order to even qualitatively describe this data. Okay, so thank you.